Welcome to The Created Life. The Created Life is a podcast featuring insightful conversations with people living life by their own rules and making a positive impact. I'm Damian Taggart, serial entrepreneur, wilderness guide, poet, and author, and I'll be your host on this journey. The Created Life is an episodic dose of inspiration, life hacks, and engaging ideas to help you grow and create a life you love. Welcome back to The Created Life. This is the second episode of The Created Life released in 2020. My goal will be to do about an episode a month. Originally, the program launched with me doing an episode per week, and mostly my focus has just been pulled into other areas. So the podcast has kind of been, unfortunately, on the back burner, but it's something that I still want to continue. Excuse me. Something that I still want to continue, and I still really enjoy, and I'd love to like put more effort into it as I have time. Just so you know, I'm changing the format slightly. I've got a few episodes already recorded, which will follow the more typical Created Life format, where it's just me interviewing someone about their work and their life. But in general, I want to kind of switch things up a bit in 2020 and tell more of my own story and give more of my own thoughts and really kind of focus in on, you know, getting to some content about how can we work together as humans to really improve our lives and to, you know, just kind of continually go on this journey of personal growth, personal development, mental, emotional, and spiritual development, and kind of from a pragmatic standpoint, thinking about life hacks for being a more effective and more creative person and how we can use that to really manifest the life that we want. So anyway, I'm looking forward to sharing all of that with you. For today, though, please enjoy my interview with Julia Goldberg, who is an author, an interviewer, a journalist here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. She and I discuss many things, including the intersection of technology and culture, the role of the journalist in society, the genre of creative nonfiction. Julia has spent years working as a writing instructor, as well as publishing books about writing. So she really knows a lot on the subject, and it's been really great to talk to her. So I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks so much for being on the show, and I appreciate this chance to get to talk to you. It actually came up because I was talking about the podcast with somebody, and they got, I can't remember who it was, some mutual acquaintance, and they got really excited and said, you should talk to Julia Goldberg because she's like such an excellent interviewer.
We should find out who that was so I can tell them to stop saying to people.
And I was like, well, what better way to find out what Julia knows about interviewing than to interview her myself?
I wrote a book on it too, so you could just read that and you don't have to.
Totally, yeah, you did write a book on it. I know. That's another thing that I was, as I was thinking about this interview, thinking about how it's interesting that you've kind of worked in so many different roles in journalism, from like intern to staff writer to beat journalists to editor. And then you took it to like an even more meta place of like writing a book about writing and teaching writing as well. So you've kind of like been in many of the different kind of roles in journalism and also thinking about being a writer. And so I kind of wanted to dig into that a little bit and find out like what first attracted you to, was it more of an interest in writing or was it journalism itself?
I think it was really the combination. I mean, I was like interviewing and interested in people even as a child. I tell this story in my book, but you know, like in elementary school where you get your class pictures and everybody would get like little wallet size photos of their friends. I would take all mine and staple them to index cards and like write everything down about, you know, I had like a file on people. So I think it was like inherent that I had that desire, and then I learned what journalism was. I guess I was editor of my high school paper, and read Hunter S. Thompson early. I was like, this seems cool. You're writing, you're interviewing people. Just, it was what I wanted to do.
That's cool. And so then that, so like from the interesting, like Hunter S. Thompson stuff, like, cause you, your book is about specifically, what did you call it? What's the genre? It's like creative nonfiction.
Yeah. And that's not, I didn't create that genre. It's sort of the genre name that kind of developed like in the early 90s to kind of encompass journalism, literary journalism, memoir, lyric essay, kind of a more overarching name for all the different subgenres of nonfiction. And in the track that I taught at Santa Fe University of Art and Design, that was one of the tracks. So,
So is creative nonfiction then kind of like a, is it a response to an earlier kind of nonfiction that was more dry or more, was it like, is, did it kind of grow in that way or?
Yeah, I think exactly. You know, I mean, you know, I found with my students and then just others that people think of nonfiction as just like the facts, you know, where they think about the five-paragraph essay that they were forced to write over and over again in high school. And creative nonfiction was just pointing out what's always been the case with nonfiction, which is that nonfiction can employ a lot of the techniques that all of the writing does. So the lyric essay, which is a subgenre of creative nonfiction, kind of melds some of the techniques of poetry with nonfiction writing. And literary journalism, when it kind of blossomed in the 70s, people were really attracted to it because it was like reading a novel or reading a fictional story, but using, you know, nonfiction.
And then was like Hunter S. Thompson kind of one of the originators of that, would you say, or is that something totally different?
Like, well, I mean, I think he fits into the literary journalism era. I mean, he of course kind of coined the kind of gonzo journalism era and it really emphasized storytelling and voice, but he was certainly part of, in the 70s, Tom Wolfe and Truman Capote and all these other, well, Truman Capote was earlier, but all these people that were telling stories, but not in a traditional kind of Associated Press, you know, Santa Fe, New Mexico, today, three people, you know, were hit by a car or whatever.
Right.
Terrible, terrible example. Not here. Here, that would be a good example.
Right. Totally. So in addition to like, so you're doing a like a bi-monthly column on the intersection of like culture and technology right now. And you're, so you wrote this book. Is there another book in the works at this point?
Well, I'm actually going to be writing more for The Reporter starting next month. I'm going to be covering politics in the coming year, which is something I really wanted to do. And then doing not just my column on technology and science, but trying to do more, just more stories in general on that topic. And then just any features. So I'll be writing more for The Reporter. I do feel like I probably have another book to write, but I honestly found it to be such a slog that I'm going to have to be like very clear on what it is.
And do you ever feel like writing outside of work at this point, or is it all of your writing energy like for your profession? And like, is there still like, are you like writing poetry or something that doesn't fit into kind of the normal workflow for you?
I do. I mean, I don't have a sort of specific passion project right now, but I mean, I kind of write, you know, I write in my journal every day, which I've done since I was like six. So I have to make a note to have everything in my house burned if I die. Journals. And yeah, I get sort of motivated to write other things, but I haven't finished anything in a while, so that's always a challenge. I do get kind of exhausted sitting in front of the computer a lot.
Right, totally. So what attracted you to kind of like writing about like the technology side of things? Like what's your interest in that?
I mean, I think part of it was maybe 2 years ago when Santa Fe Institute had their announced they were going to do the Interplanetary Festival. I just thought it was interesting, and I wanted an excuse to call people up and ask them questions. So I pitched the story to The Reporter, and they said, sure. And then after I talked with a bunch of folks up there, I just started looking around and realizing how much Santa Fe was starting to have in that realm. And not just sort of tech and science and culture, but just kind of interdisciplinary and people doing interesting things. And I felt like there was enough there to make it kind of a regular beat. I think too that as a reporter, I mean, as the editor of The Reporter, I almost, all I did was write about politics because I read all the endorsements. And so I was a little like worn out of just, I just like had enough of that. I just wanted kind of a new topic to kind of jump into and learn more about.
Cool. What has like been some of the more interesting things that you've gotten to cover in that column?
I interviewed a quantum physicist for this year's Interplanetary Festival, and I thought that was really interesting. Just he talked a lot about, he's got a book coming out on the many worlds theory, and I thought that was interesting. San Fe Institute is really good in that all the people there are working in sort of high-level realms, but they're good at explaining things to people. So I feel like I get to learn stuff that I might not otherwise know about. And then I've been really interested, especially in the last year, thinking about machine learning and AI and automation, which I think is going to play such a big role in our society. So I interviewed a AI specialist who just moved his company here named Savory Sansoy, and started a robotics meetup. So I interviewed him, and he showed me a bunch of the robots that he's built, and that was pretty fun.
That's cool. And his name is Sabri Sansoy?
Yeah, hopefully I got that right.
Yeah, and he, that piece was like titled something interesting like...
The machines aren't coming, they're already here.
That's right.
That was his screensaver when I was talking to him. I looked over at his computer. It was like, okay.
The machines aren't coming, they're already here. And yeah. So what did he mean by that?
I think he meant that... and I don't know that he coined that notion, but just, you know, his basic point was that we already have AI, we already have machine learning, and a lot of the scenarios that people are afraid of are going to involve, like, pretty huge advances in the area of machine learning that we're not anywhere near. But he sort of feels like, yeah, either the machines are going to take over, we're already living in a simulation, or we're going to become cyborgs. You know, he has sort of a matter-of-fact perception. So... And I have a love of science fiction. Anything that makes me think of The Matrix seems fun.
Totally. That's cool. So he's pretty optimistic about the way that machines will impact humanity. Is that right? Like, what do you think about that? Like, kind of...
You know, I don't know exactly what I think. I mean, I think I tend to not think any advancement or technology or platform has inherent good or evil in it.
Right.
I'm not sure the internet provides a very good object lesson about our ability to use technology for good, because so much of it's a shit show. But, you know, in the beginning, sort of thought, oh, look at this, like, egalitarian platform, and look at how other voices are going to be heard and all of these things that could happen, without ever thinking of, like, the regulatory environment or social media or all the crazy things that have occurred. So I tend to think it's similar, that as long as there's avarice, there'll be some way in which machine learning will probably not benefit people. And certainly, like, some of the automation predictions and what that's going to do to American work and workers
taking
everywhere.
Jobs and stuff.
Yeah, taking jobs and particularly impacting people who are already, you know, living in some level of poverty is, you know, that's not very optimistic. On the other hand, there's things happening with AI and, like, in the field of telemedicine and the field of helping people with disabilities that are really promising and really exciting. So... Mm-hmm. I don't know, I taught a class, what was it called? I don't remember what it was called. It was some like gender sci-fi class that I thought was fun. And we talked a lot about like post-humanism. And we looked at videos of people who are already trying to become cyborgs by like putting, you know, like RDIF chips in their arms and things like that. So it's already happening, just not widespread yet.
Right. That's cool. I've never heard post-humanism before. What is that?
I think it just means sort of that era in which that we're kind of coming to where... You know, people will have, to some degree, machines, as you know, integrate with machines.
Inseparable
more.
From our technology in
yeah.
a way? Yeah. That's cool. Okay.
You can take a test online that finds out whether or not you're a post-humanist. I'll see if I can find the link.
Okay, cool. Find out if you're a post-humanist. Okay, cool. And getting back to, like, this idea of, what was the, sorry, I'm spacing on the genre again, creative nonfiction. Yeah. So how is that related to like documentary film, and or do you see like a similar trajectory like with creative nonfiction and documentary film?
Well, I'm not really as familiar with how documentary films are made, but I think, you know, we all tend to like stories that have story in them, right? We're not just looking for information. And so, you know, to me, a lot of creative nonfiction, it's taking... You know, it's making interesting structural choices, and it's creating characters, and it's doing all the things you would expect from, you know, from fiction.
Right.
And sometimes it's very experiential and it's not, you know, experimental and it's not necessarily narrative or storytelling. So I would imagine similar things are happening in the documentary film era, but I feel like the only documentaries I've seen lately were, I saw that new Prince documentary that they showed, and what else? Yeah, I have kind of a junky taste in movies, as you know from running into me at the movies last night.
Right. So. That's cool. Yeah. In terms of, like, what is your take on, like, the role of the journalist and kind of the importance of journalism and how you've seen that shift in, like, the 20 years or so that you've been working in the field?
Well, I mean, I have a sort of old-fashioned view of journalism, which I think, which is, you know, the old expression champion the oppressed and oppress the rich and that kind of thing. That's not the actual expression. Why am I not going to remember it? I'll remember it later after I leave. So I definitely think, you know, journalists play an important role in getting public information and holding public officials accountable and also telling stories about community, especially local journalism in this day and age when we're so kind of under siege from sort of generic national news. I think it's a really important way that people know what's happening in their community. The biggest change is, I don't know that I actually think journalism's mission has changed at all. I just think the conditions under which journalists try to do that work have changed dramatically. Everything from sort of the 24/7 news cycle and journalists sort of having to really compete and churn things out to the sort of eroding of respect for the role that media plays that's been kind of propagated by, you know, I think the president and generally, I mean, it's not just Trump, you know, even 20 years ago, I think it's, when I was starting out, it's just a natural tendency when people don't like something that's written to just try to discredit it. I think it's just how it goes, but it's become kind of a more mainstream.
Just vitriolic.
Yeah.
Like, without regard to what's real, in a way.
Yeah. Kind of. Comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. That's the expression I was looking for.
Comfort the afflicted and
afflict the comfortable.
Afflict the comfortable. Okay, that's interesting. Do you remember where that came from?
I feel like maybe that's a, you know, Mencken expression, but I'm not 100% sure. We could Google it.
Okay, cool. So tell me a little bit about your book, Inside Story.
Sure. I guess when I started teaching, I was very enthusiastic and I had lots of PowerPoint presentations and lectures and handouts and I just had so much information and I kept thinking, I wish there was a book that had like everything in it that I wanted to have students read. You know, I just like had all this stuff amassed and I thought, well, probably the only way you're going to have a book that says everything you want to say and has all the things you want people to read is if you actually put that book together. So
right.
I had a lot of materials. And so it basically, it's called Inside Story, Everyone's Guide to Reporting and Writing Creative Nonfiction. And it kind of takes folks, it was sort of intended as a teaching book, but I think you could, you know, use it on your own just to take people through the process of everything from finding story ideas to interviewing people to figuring out how to structure your story, to figure out how to edit your story. So it's a pretty kind of basic primer.
Cool. That's awesome.
It's kind of how I teach the... I taught an intro to creative nonfiction and then the intermediate and then the advanced levels of those courses. So it kind of puts all that together.
That's really cool. And have you, or as a teacher, have you seen any like real, like great success stories with some of your students?
I mean, I think so. I think I've had, I mean, I wouldn't say like success stories necessarily as related to my classes, but a lot of the students I had at Santa Fe University of Art and Design, or they're in graduate school right now, or they've continued writing, or they have jobs as writers. And some of the early students I had at the community college where I teach fiction, intermittently, they've all become kind of published writers and worked on it. So I think, you know, as a general rule, once people are in a classroom and they're intent, they find some level of success. And the one nice thing I'll say about the internet is that there's so many outlets now for people to get their work into the world. And I think that helps kind of give momentum to people when they're working that they can get it out. It's not all just sitting in your house with piles of unpublished stories.
Mm-hmm. With creative nonfiction, do you see, is most of the work that you see kind of in the more like autobiographical or personal history sort of realm, or how do you see that?
When I teach it, the students would always have three assignments, and one would be a memoir, and one would be what I call reported nonfiction, where they're kind of going more outside themselves, but also bringing kind of creator storytelling, and the other would be a piece of criticism, or arts criticism or something like that. Memoir is usually where I start because it is the most accessible, because we all have our memories and our internal stories or something we're trying to work out in writing. So it's a place where, especially, you know, a lot of writers, present company excluded or shy, so being like, you have to go interview people or you have to go be in the world can be intimidating, but I think we can all kind of reach inward when we're trying to write, so it tends to be, which is not to say that people love to do it, because sometimes it's also hard to write about yourself, but it's at least you're carrying those stories around with you.
That's cool. One of the things that jumped out at me as you were talking about those assignments was that, like, criticism is something that, like, I think, having been, like, out of college for, like, 20 years or something, like, I haven't read a lot of criticism of, like, literary criticism or anything like that. Like, and I was thinking the only place that I still consistently read critical writing is, like, movie reviews and things like that, or even, like, on a much more, like, pedestrian level, like, product reviews written by whoever. But it's interesting, like, I guess where else do you see critical writing being really important and relevant for the general population?
Well, I don't know if it's the general population per se, because I'm not 100% what other people read or don't read. But I mean, I love reading cultural criticism that looks at things that are being created, and I don't like reviews necessarily, but find something interesting to say about them and how what they're saying, what their existence says about what's happening.
Critical analysis of, like, art and, like, yeah, I get that. Okay, cool.
So, you know, I read Slate a lot, and I listen to Slate's podcast, Culture Gabfest. And, you know, like, half the time I want to go to a movie solely so I can, like, read what the Times or the New Yorker or somebody else wrote about it and, like, bounce that against having actually
Cool.
So those tend to be sort of like where, you know, and I'll read anything. I read a lot of magazines.
That's cool. Yeah, I guess I think I do read a lot of things like that, and I didn't really just think of them as criticism, but it totally is. That makes sense. Cool.
It justifies me watching TV, because I'll be like, oh, this brilliant TV critic is writing about this, so I'll go watch it.
Right. That's cool. Who are some of your, like, biggest influences and, like, teachers?
You mean, like, things I've read, or
just like people that you really have drawn inspiration from in your life? Like, you know, it doesn't even have to be like directly connected to your career or anything, but just like who when you look at, like, whether it's like writers or, you know, just like what are things that you kind of voices, whether it's like music or writing or whatever it is, that really have resonated for you and kind of propelled you to be the person that you are?
That's a good question. I wonder if I have an answer for that. I mean, I was definitely inspired by Hunter S. Thompson when I was a teenager. And, you know, he'd written Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail 72 many, many years before I was in high school. I wasn't reading it in real time. But it just made me so excited about politics, and it made me so excited about writing and kind of being able to, like, be in the world and have your own voice and do interesting things. So that book had a pretty big impact on me. You know, and Hunter, people tend to emphasize with Hunter S. Thompson, like, you know, sort of like the drugs and the craziness. But, you know, like, that man, like, knew the political system backwards and forwards, and he was fearless. You know, and he was kind of a beat reporter. You know, you can't, like, report in a presidential campaign without really understanding the ins and outs of caucuses and all this stuff. So it definitely kind of inspired me to want to understand how politics works and how civics work. And I still don't think I understand it fully, and at this point I don't know if anyone understands anything fully. There's a writer named Janet Malcolm who's very influential in general in journalism, and she wrote a book called The Journalist and the Murderer that I've probably read like 20 times and taught whenever I have the chance, because I just think it's fascinating. She's someone who bridges writing about journalism with a really deep interest in psychology and psychoanalysis. And so The Journalist and the Murderer is about a guy who was convicted of killing his wife and child, and it's about the journalist who he hired to write about him, and then it's about him suing the journalist, and the jury being more sympathetic to a man who murdered his wife and child than they were more mad at the journalist for what they felt like he had misrepresented himself than they were at the guy who killed his wife and child. And she tries to like unpack that and sort of understand the dynamic of it. Mm. And I just think it's such an interesting book. And
yeah, that sounds fascinating.
It never stops being interesting to me. She also wrote a really interesting book called In the Freud Archives. And she wrote a book about The Silent Woman that's about the literary legal disputes that happened around Sylvia Plath's estate. So she's just very interesting at kind of like analyzing these stories. So she's not just telling the story, she's trying to figure out like the dynamics of what happened. And I don't know that I will have ever or will ever get to her level of thought leadership and being able to do that, but I find the way she writes about things really inspiring.
That's cool. Yeah, thank you. Recently, you also wrote a piece called Digital Despair, and you talk about, it was in your column, and you talk about the kind of, hegemonic control that, the unprecedented control that CEOs like Mark Zuckerberg potentially have over speech. Hmm. Is that something that like you worry about, or what are your thoughts on that?
It's funny that I have no memory what that piece was about. Can you read me some of it? What was I saying?
It was just talking about, I think it was, I don't remember exactly, but it was...
Was it in response to one of his mentors coming out and saying, was it about the people talking about breaking up social media?
Yeah, exactly. It was somebody else who was a co-founder of Facebook saying, advocating like separating Facebook and Instagram and kind of breaking up that as a monopoly, antitrust kind of thing.
Sure. I mean, from the get-go, had a lot of like hesitation around social media as it related to being a journalist, because I just felt like, I have to do this. And now I feel that same sense of, like, Facebook to me is such a just, like, hellhole. Every time I go on it, I see people I like and respect posting, like, four-year-old stories as if they were just published, or things from, like, weird news sites. Like, it's just this mess. It's, like, the worst possible scenario of how I could get information, and yet I'm not allowed to just quit it. I mean, I guess I could, but it'd make it really hard for me to do some of the things I'm responsible for doing, like posting things on Facebook.
Right.
And you know, I also just think, I don't know, you look at all of this sort of terrible trolling that happens and the doxing that happens to people on Twitter, and especially to women, it really shines a light on kind of the worst of people.
Right.
And it's hard to feel like it's good at this time and place in history to have this like milieu in which people get to be their worst selves.
Yeah, it feels definitely kind of like a cesspool of like base human instinct sometimes.
Yeah.
I think there are like positive things about it too, for sure. Like I've actually met a lot of cool people through Facebook that then I become like real life friends with, and that's been an interesting kind of reversal to that for me, but I think that's unusual. I don't think most people are not necessarily using it in that way.
I've heard that happens for people. And I know there's people who, I think maybe because Instagram, I feel like is sort of this like friendly place where I just see people I know and post photos of things we're eating. It seems kind of benign. But you know, Twitter and Facebook I primarily use in kind of a professional capacity, and I just find it like, well, and
right.
I didn't feel that way when it started. I used to be like communicate with my friends, my actual friends on
right.
Facebook.
And family or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, well, not so much that.
Less than family.
But you know, I just think because there's sort of this unprecedented new form of communication, nobody had really understood how to regulate it or manage it, and now it's just this mess. I don't know that deregulation or, you know, breaking the companies up is a solution, because you know, breaking up monopolies is not some easy thing to do, and sometimes creates subsidiary problems, and who knows if it's even legal for it to happen. But
right, totally. Yeah, I definitely don't have like a clear sense of what like the right solution for those types of things are. I think it's like a worthy conversation to be having. And I do think that even when there's not like regulation in place. I think, like, you know, even if companies like Facebook started to do really bad types of like censorship of people's political ideas or something like that, I feel like there would be enough public outrage against that that would kind of hold them into some kind of account. I have some optimism around that, but yeah, I think it's like, you know, it's been interesting for me, like the last, I don't know, I took maybe 2 or 3 months off of all social media, like everything, didn't use like any online services for like a few months over the last 6 months. And honestly, my life was like better for sure. Like I felt, but you know, it is weird because you can't, like, it's hard to organize events. It's hard to promote products. It's hard to, like, you know, there's things that like you really, especially from a business perspective, like kind of need to use social media because there's so many eyeballs on it. It's like, it's the way to get news out in a way, or like, or when you're a small business or when you're trying to promote something. But yeah, I found time off of social media to like just feel more expansive. Like I realized after a few days, like how much I was like opening my phone and like normally would just click on Facebook or just whatever, just mm-hmm. like, and it was kind of nice to have the experience of not having that option and being like, oh, I'm going to allow myself to think other thoughts or just like daydream for a minute and like prioritize, you know, just some space. And I think that, yeah, it was definitely a good thing for me. So I definitely encourage anybody who has the ability to take time off from it to do it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think there's more and more kind of suggestions coming out about ways to sort of unplug that I need to utilize more.
Yeah, you also wrote a piece about something called new collar jobs. Can you tell me what that is? Like, what is a new collar job?
I feel like you're testing me. What was that story? if I'm not mistaken, that was a story about Sarah Boisrud, who runs the Fab Lab, which is a project that grew out of MIT, and it's training people to get these certifications for what they consider to be kind of the manufacturing jobs of the future that are going to require more like 3D printing and different kinds of skills. So, so new collar, it's kind of blue collar, new collar, instead of, it's a way of sort of training people to be prepared for the fact that some of the machines that have been traditionally used are going to be, you know, eventually replaced by these new machines. They're going to have a big conference here, I think, a new manufacturing conference in November that I'm probably going to write about as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. So is the sense with these new collar jobs that they're going to be somewhat less, like, replaceable? Like, people will have these jobs, or are they still, like, jobs that might be lost because of automation or something like that?
I think the idea is less so because, you know, sort of like old school machining jobs, you learned how to use a specific piece of machinery and that's what you were trained in. So then that machine becomes obsolete and you don't have a job. But I think with these new collar jobs and with a lot of the new technology, it's more about learning a skill set and a way of thinking critically about how to use certain kinds of machines. So you end up evolving as your job evolves, not unlike how for all our generation or my generation, I don't know how old you are, you know, we learn how to use computers. Mm-hmm. It's not like if my MacBook dies, I'm like, oh God, now I can no longer use a computer. Like, I know how the basic infrastructure of computing. And it's the same thing, I think, that, you know, the journalists had to go through when social media and multimedia and all these other tools started coming out, which is, and what I've learned in teaching is teaching anyone to use it one piece of software and nothing else is not really serving them, because that software could go away or mm-hmm. change, or you have to teach people to learn how to think about the tool. So I think the new collar jobs are kind of a way of looking at factories as becoming factories of the future, where you're learning the skill set versus just learning how to use one machine.
A way of problem solving and thinking about problems and stuff. That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. That, as it was explained to me, I haven't spent any time in factories, so that's mm-hmm. very secondhand understanding.
That's cool. Going back to kind of your work as a journalist, through your career, you've probably interviewed like thousands of people, yeah? Like,
I mean, I think that's safe.
Yeah, so
Terry Gross one time was like talking about, she had like the exact number of people she'd interviewed, and I was like, what are you counting? That's crazy. She's probably interviewed more than I have, but mm-hmm. I would have to think probably, yeah, somewhere in that vicinity.
So what do you think about, or can you talk a little bit about the format of the interview? What do you think about the interview as a tool, as a way of storytelling, or how do you think about it?
I think about it as like the single most valuable thing a person can do, because, you know, I think when you're talking to, I think of interviews as primarily being like a formal conversation. I don't tend to, I write down a few questions before I'm interviewing somebody, but I try to leave enough space to also just have a conversation. And I think that when you're asking people to tell you about themselves and their stories, you're not thinking about yourself, which is like the single most valuable thing I think anyone can ever do, is like have some time in the day when they're not like pontificating about themselves. Maybe other people don't do it as much as I do. And I think it connects people, right? And when you have a connection with someone, they are a human being to you, and hopefully you've learned something that you didn't know, and hopefully they've been sort of seen in a way that they hadn't before. I mean, I found that a lot of people, I haven't found too many people that don't want to tell you their story. You know, I think everybody has that desire. The writer Joan Didion, whom I admire a lot, has a famous essay that starts, we tell, or I don't know if it starts that way, but it says, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. And I think it's just, we have a natural innate desire to create like a narrative around our lives and want to talk about things. So when I was at Santa Fe University of Art and Design, they had schools in other countries. I don't really know exactly how it worked. And they sent me to a few of them to teach journalism workshops. And I always start in those workshops by making students interview one another. And I was in Mexico City, I think, and I looked over, they were all interviewing each other. I looked over, and these two students were sitting there, like, sobbing. And I was like, oh, good, what's happened here? And I went over, ¿qué pasa? And they'd been friends for a really long time, and they had never asked each other questions, certain questions about things that they wanted to know, just, you know, out of shyness or out of just feeling like they couldn't. And I think, you know, an interview gives you that, it gives you that freedom to just ask a question, which I think is sort of the basis of understanding things. So I think it's very important.
That's really cool. Yeah. Has your approach to the interview changed a lot in your time as a journalist?
Yeah, I mean, certainly starting out, I get pretty overwrought, especially if I was interviewing anyone in a position of power. I'd write out a million questions. I'd try to be really, really prepared. And then, you know, I was on the radio. I had a show for about a year where I would interview probably 5 or 6 people a day, every day, and I just couldn't prepare at that level, and realized, like, I didn't really need to, because I can sort of think on my feet at this point. So I do tend to come in a little bit more relaxed and not, like, as overly prepared. And one of the funnest things in my book was my book is not just me pontificating. I interviewed, like, dozens and dozens and dozens of writers and journalists of all stripes, and I really enjoyed talking to other journalists about like their interviewing process, because everyone sort of swears by their own technique. There's journalists who are like, oh, I never prepare, and others that are like, oh, I research heavily, and you know, so I think it's really just where you feel you're kind of in a groove, and sometimes it backfires, for sure. I've had some catastrophic ones even after many years of doing it.
Really? Like, yeah. What's an example of that?
Well, I'm not going to name names, but I interviewed a somewhat famous actor whom I asked a few questions that were supposed to be humorous, and this person did not have a sense of humor, did not think they were funny, so things did not go very well.
So it just fell flat?
Yeah, it was just horrendous.
Like awkward silences in the interview?
Like mad at me, kind of yelling. I interviewed the writer Margaret Atwood, whom I just admire so deeply, and I had written one of my grad school papers on her, and I just prepared. I mean, I had like 30 pages of questions, and she was like, oh my god, when does this end? Like, why won't you stop asking me questions? I just have 50 more questions. Like, I just was, you know, out of my mind. I think the story turned out fine, but you don't feel that great about, you know, making...
Right, the human connection level of it was weird. Yeah. That's interesting. Okay. I just forgot what I was going to ask. Or what advice, if any, would you give somebody who is considering journalism as a field, and I guess relatedly, maybe somebody's not going directly into journalism, but is just interested in becoming a, you know, storyteller of some kind in like writing creative nonfiction, or like, what would you say to someone who's like starting out on that journey, regardless of whether they're young or old or whatever point they're in, but just what would you say?
I would say do it. I mean, I can't think of too many. I think no matter what field you're in, there's value in knowing how to tell your story, tell other people's stories. It's just kind of like a human, they said, I think a human impulse to do it. And I think the more you're in the world, the more you'll have material. And there's so many opportunities, you know, to write and be in the world writing. And I don't think it's something that translates at an abstract level. Like, you just have to get in and just start doing it. And then it grows, you know.
Right.
I mean, the best advice I ever got when I was a teenager from an editor somewhere who I got to talk to was like, if you want to be a writer, just write. And if you keep doing it, at some point you'll be like, I've been a writer for 20 years.
Right.
20 years now. But it's true, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's like anything else. You just have to take a bite out of the elephant.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was, you know, in college age, I don't remember what year, but like I was starting to get into like wanting to write short stories and thinking about I want to write a novel and stuff like that. But at that time, I think I was way more motivated by the idea of like I want to write than actually knowing anything that I wanted to write about. And so that was like it was a lot of failures, really. It was a lot of like, I mean, I wrote stories, but they just weren't really that good, I think. And I kind of got away from it for a long time. I just did a bunch of other things, and then more recently in my life got back into writing, and now it's like it just flows and I don't have to like, there's just no effort to it. I mean, there's effort if I want to go back and edit and revise and make sure it's like actually good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been an interesting journey going from really just sitting there trying to force something onto paper and then having a lot to just say. And I don't know if that's a common experience, but it's been interesting for me.
I think there's definitely muscle memory involved with it. You know, if you're doing it all the time, it becomes more natural.
Mm-hmm.
Not unlike really like any form of exercise. I don't actually remember if I put this in my book or not, but I was talking about, I think, Yo-Yo Ma, and I'd read an article about him and how much he practices. And I was like, you know, someone who's like inherently just kind of a genius of any sort practices, it's a reminder that even if you're a natural writer, like, you're just going to have to write. Like,
mm-hmm.
It's not just saying, oh, if you happen to sit down, you're going to be brilliant at it, so.
Right, totally. And same if you're, like, a runner or something. You have to keep running. You can't just stop. Yeah, totally. I remembered what I was going to say earlier. You were talking about kind of being more in the moment, in the flow with an interview and having to prepare less because you were more competent and thinking on your feet. And that's something I've been thinking about a lot lately
I should say, or so I think. I mean, who knows?
It's like, yeah. It's an interesting thing, like, in a larger way. Like, you think about people who can do, or in like, not just in the context of writing, I guess, like, but I think about people who can do, like, freestyle rap, or they can, or, like, dancers that can do, like, improvisational dance, or there's something, like, really interesting and compelling about getting into that space of almost like, I guess, like unconscious competence where you can just like really just tap into something and not be so concerned with like trying to like determine how you're going to be viewed beforehand, or like, you know, thinking through how will people respond to my interview questions, you know, or it's like all that preparation is in some ways like, or can be, and sometimes like, to try to control the outcome. And I think it's cool when people are brave enough to be in the space of, I'm not really sure what the outcome is, and I'm just going to go with my gut, or like go with my heart, or something like that. Is that kind of like, does that ring true for you in terms of like what you were saying about interviewing? Like, is that kind of the way you think about it, or are you thinking about it in a different way?
It's possible. I haven't thought about it. I mean, I would certainly say, like, yeah, I'm probably much less self-conscious. And I'll, you know, I think, too, I don't just walk up to people on the street and go, hey, can I ask you a question? I mean, like, I always sort of have an appointment and they've agreed to interview me, you know, to be interviewed. So there's sort of that
consent level. Yeah,
yeah. There's that comfort level. And I think, too, the practice thing comes back to it because, you know, I think when you're interviewing someone to a large degree, not to a large degree, to some degree it's performative, right? I mean, you're kind of creating this like artificial identity in order to interview, which, you know, just becomes more natural to be able to kind of slip into that and do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And still, I mean, I have plenty of flaws in it. I over-interview people. I'll talk to someone for an hour for a really short story and then be done and be like, oh God, what have I done? You know, because I get really interested and in having the conversations. So,
right.
But I think that's sort of what's nice about, you know, journalism and writing in general, is that even if you've done it a lot, there's always the possibility of failure, because every story is a new story, every topic's a new topic. I mean, the possibility of failure isn't what's fun about it, but it's hard to, you can't really check out to do it, to be present.
Right, totally. So, what problems do you think are worth solving in the world right now?
gosh, I would probably all the big ones, right? Climate change, poverty, racism, sexism, you know, all of those are worth solving in my mind.
And you see your work as a journalist, like, playing into some of those?
I mean, it's a complicated question, because I don't want to, like, sound as though I have some sort of hubris around it, where I'm like, yes, I'm helping to solve the problems of the world. I do think, you know, I have, I guess, this working thought that I've had for a really long time, based on an article I read a really long time ago, which is that, like, if you do anything, write an article or put on an event, you do anything that makes one person change a little bit, mm-hmm. learn something new, or want to go do something new, or get involved with something new, or feel differently, then you have helped.
You've made some kind of impact, yeah.
So, yeah, I would like to think that even if it's just... But, you know, somebody enjoyed it, that's sort of, at least you're not just putting out more bile into the world, I suppose.
Right, totally.
But, you know, in terms of actually, like, writing something that is, like, has a huge impact, I don't know. I mean, I think that's everybody's dream, but
right.
It's hard to say what that would be. There's a lot of pretty great things being said and done in the world by people in all different fields, and it's hard to say if we've reached a tipping point where any of them are going to solve any of the problems that we have. But I hope so.
Totally. And I mean, it seems likely that most of those, like, large scale problems will be solved in these, like, small incremental steps, as opposed to just, like, you know, I mean, it might be some, like, sea change that just happens, like, very quickly, like a kind of a, like a tipping point kind of thing. But it also might just be, like, a slow evolutionary process, you know, that, like, maybe has ups and downs and isn't, like, a direct path, but...
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know that we ever see the changes as they're happening. You know, I think about something like 9/11, where we just felt like, oh, God, the world's never going to be the same, and it wasn't, but not, like, the next day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the changes that were wrought by these big events, they come on slowly, and I don't know that we can recognize them in the moment.
Totally. Do you still believe in democracy?
I do still believe in democracy, yeah.
Do you think it's fundamentally functional in the U.S. right now, or not really?
I do not think it's fundamentally functional in the U.S. right now. I do think journalism plays an important role mm-hmm. in ensuring democracy, and I think, you know, the first step in trying to dismantle democracy is trying to dismantle the free press, and mm-hmm. that's why I feel, like, so strongly about not doing anything besides journalism at this point in history. Yeah, I think democracy is, well, I think it's almost always under threat one way or another. It certainly feels especially threatened right mm-hmm. now in the current administration. But, you know, I also think we have to believe in our, if we believe in stuff, we have to believe that they're strong enough to not just be toppled by a few years and one person.
Right, totally. That, like, the fundamental aspects of our communities are built of something stronger than just this, like, political quagmire. And
exactly. We can talk again in November 2020 and we'll see
yeah.
how we're feeling. But
totally. So I mean, is there anything else that you wanted to add to this interview that we haven't touched on, or subjects or things that you feel like chatting about?
I guess the only thing I would say is that in addition to writing and teaching, I'm the president of the Reporters Nonprofit, the New Mexico Fund for Public Interest Journalism, and one of the main projects I have is as a mentor, where we take 4 students in the fall and then the spring semesters. They get paid $500. They work directly with me to learn about reporting, and then they work on a story that gets published in the Reporter. And I just, one thing that's, I think, I hope works itself out in the next few years is this weird, like, generational divide of, like, kind of the young and the old pitted against each other in some way. I think it's kind of horrendous, and I don't want to participate in it. And I feel like if there's anyone in their 20s who I can help, I want to help them in the way that some people helped me in my 20s. And assuming I get to be even older than I am now, I hope I don't ever be like, you be quiet, you're being too loud. Like, you know, I just feel like anyone who's young should respect the old, because with any luck, they'll be old. And anyone who's old should respect the young, because we were young. Like, of all the divisions, it seems like the most senseless.
Oh, God, yeah, right? Totally. So. That's a really good point. No, I've thought about that a lot. I think we are in some ways impoverished by a lack of connection outside of our cohorts. So, you know, it's like we tend to be, I was thinking about that, like, you know, basically from my college years on, it was like I was always hanging out with people who were my own age, and or those are my primary like social interactions. And recently it's become a much wider, you know, I guess really since I had kids and just also became a little bit more open-minded and realized that this was going on in my life. But like, you know, connecting with older people has been a really interesting thing. And like, I think there's so much, like I've started to like really seek out mentorship in a way that I wished I had done earlier in my life. I had a few bad relationships with like authority figures or my parents or whatever. And like, so kind of dismissed a lot of that, where I think it's been so helpful to actually find people who are like, have been around longer and have some like perspective that you don't have. So I think that's a really great point.
Yeah. And all the millennial bashing, I just find really offensive. I mean, having had so many students in that generation, I think are terrific.
Totally.
Cool people. And it's like, you know what? Every generation gets to have their own style and their own way of looking at the world. I don't understand like why anyone would feel like it's okay to be like,
I know, it's just this like really, it's this really hackneyed like kids these days kind of attitude that just doesn't like, it doesn't really hold up to any kind of scrutiny. So that's a really good point.
Although Gen X is the best, but still.
The best. Gen X is the best. Cool. So let's see. So a question I've been like kind of closing with and asking all of my guests is, basically if you could, you know, sort of give one idea or practice that could spread virally to all people, like what would that be? What's your, like, if you could just sort of flip a switch and say, you know, this is a thing that's been helpful in my life, either a way of looking at the world or something that you do, like a daily practice or something like that, that you could just give to all people and they would benefit from it.
What I make everyone do.
You could wave your magic wand, yeah.
I mean, I read every day, and I feel like reading is like the most important thing people should do. Like, I'm surprised at how little people read anymore. Do you read?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you know these people that don't read?
For sure.
I'm encountering a lot of people who are like, oh, I never read. I'm like, that's so sad.
I mean, I've been through big chunks of my life where I'm not reading a lot of fiction, and it's just like nonfiction and or like work-related reading, and then like a lot of, I think, you know, articles and things like that. But yeah, I go in and out of it, I think. But I do know what you mean. I think
reading something every day for fun and pleasure is important. It tends to lead to something else, you know. It tends to, you know, I think we end up in these like constrained little boxes of our lives, and the more things we have that take us out of them, the better. And reading is an easy way to take yourself out of it if you don't feel like going and doing something else.
Totally, I love that. It's like just being open to the ideas of another person and how those like interact with your own life. And similar to what you're saying about kind of the interview as a way to connect and as a way to like kind of honor another person's story.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate your time today.
These are great questions. It was fun talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for this episode of The Created Life. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends about it or support us with a donation. Also, please let me know what you liked or didn't like about the show, and if you've got a suggestion for an interview or topic you would like TCL to cover, you can send a message to Damian@Wildest. That's Damian@WILD.IST. See you next time.